Hello, and welcome to Unerasing LGBTQ History and Identities, a podcast. I'm Deb Fowler, co-founder of History Unerased. For this deep dive and backstory episode, we had the opportunity to speak with the Honorable Patrick Murphy, who has served our nation and American democracy in many capacities, in the military, then in Congress, as a statesman, and now as an educator, entrepreneur, and a regular commentator on national news. I have a personal connection to this episode, and our colleague Danny Roberts does too. You will learn about all of that serendipity in the outro. But first, Kathleen Barker, our podcast host, will provide the historical context for why we wanted to speak with Patrick. Take it away, Kathleen.
Don't ask, don't tell. Four seemingly simple words that defined American military policy and ruined thousands of lives between 1993 and 2010. Of course, homophobia and discrimination in the armed forces were nothing new. During World War II, the United States Selective Service System declared that anyone suspected of, quote, homosexual proclivities could be excluded from the draft. The military even developed guidelines to help recruiters identify and thereby exclude gay men from their ranks. Despite these attempts at exclusion, many gender and sexually diverse Americans joined the military. A 1981 Defense Department policy openly discriminated against gays and lesbians, stating that, quote, homosexuality is incompatible with military service. Over the next decade, more than 17,000 service members were discharged as a result of this belief that military service was somehow incompatible with queerness. This egregious loss of talent brought about a new policy, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, in 1993, which allowed gays and lesbians to serve in the military as long as they kept their sexual orientation a secret. By 2008, more than 12,000 officers had been discharged for making their sexual orientation public. Patrick Murphy, a young congressman from Pennsylvania, who had also served in the military, saw the negative effects of this policy firsthand. In 2009, he spearheaded a campaign to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The History Unerased team sat down with him to learn more about his work and why he believes the military could and should be a leader when it comes to inclusion.
Welcome, Patrick. First, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure, I'm Patrick Murphy. I'm from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. I was blessed that I joined the Army at age 19. So I'm a veteran and joined, and the Army changed my life. I went on to become an Army officer through ROTC, and then eventually went to law school and then served as a professor at West Point, where I taught constitutional law, and then was there when 9/11 happened and deployed to combat twice, including the invasion in Iraq, where I lost 19 of my brothers in our infantry unit with the 82nd Airborne Division. And I came back home. I wanted to make a change in the world, and I came back home and ran for the U.S. Congress and became the first Iraq war veteran elected to Congress. And eventually, years later, became the 32nd Undersecretary of the Army under President Obama and the Acting Secretary of the Army.
You mentioned being in the military. You saw the effects of Don't Ask, Don't Tell firsthand while you were serving. So what was that experience like?
You know, I grew up in a rural house in Northeast Philadelphia, so you cared about the people that lived, you know, that were attached to your house on the left and the right, shared a front step with another home. And in the military, it was the same way. You love the brothers and sisters that you get the honor to serve with. They are the best of the best. They are incredible Americans who wear the cloth of our country. But you get to see sometimes how people aren't treated the right way. And, you know, I would go through the toughest schools, airborne school, air assault school. And I was getting ready for Ranger school when one of my colleagues I found out that he got thrown out of the military. And this is someone that I bled with, someone that I had graduated with. And I just was absolutely heartbroken because he was such a phenomenal leader. He was the best officer that I went through the course with. And you know, when you see it with your own eyes, it's just another thing. It's just another thing that just, you can't unsee it. And to me, it's simple. You're either willing to stand for equality or not. And you're either willing to fight for it or you don't. And I stand for equality, and I stand for, you know, fighting for what's right. That's how my parents taught my brother, sister, and I. And so I know whatever perch I was in life, you know, trying to change it. So when I was, you know, when I was a professor at West Point, you know, I would teach constitutional law, and I would teach about the Equal Protection Clause and what equality is all about. And I would challenge my students. And then, you know, when I had the opportunity to go into combat, when I came home and ran for the Congress, I quickly realized that when Congress passed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which again kicked out over 13,000 troops that were serving honorably in our military just because of who they loved, just because they happened to be gay, it was wrong. So we had the first hearing in my committee, the Personnel Subcommittee with the Armed Service Committee, and I took on the fight to repeal it and to right this wrong.
So one of the things we've been talking about at History Unerased is just in terms of taking on different battles. It seems like a lot of politicians today are less willing to stand up for, or, you know, follow certain principles, follow maybe their morals. So I guess it's, first of all, admirable that you did. And how do you think that kind of affected your time in Congress and your experience?
Yeah, I think part of it, most of it, is because I had a blue-collar upbringing. Yeah, you know, my dad was a Navy veteran. My grandfather served in the Navy in the Pacific. My two uncles served in the Army and in Vietnam. And my brother and I served. And my sister is a public school teacher. But, you know, at a very young age, my parents were very clear that, you know, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. I grew up literally and figuratively fighting. Fist fights a lot, played hockey in college, led the team in points and penalties. But I also fought for injustices that I saw throughout my life. And that major injustice was kicking out my brothers and sisters because they happened to be gay. And, you know, a lot of folks, you know, question, well, because now it seems so plain and so like, people can't believe we had that policy. But you know, change is hard. As Bobby Kennedy once said, you know, moral courage is more rare than physical courage. And to have that moral courage to stand up and do what's right, I think that is what's missing in Congress right now. And I think people see it on both sides of the aisle. People are willing to play politics over policy. And as educators that are listening to this podcast, you know, and people who love our country, it's our duty to let people know what right looks like. And when we were fighting to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you know, my local newspaper in suburban Philadelphia, the Bucks County Courier Times, they literally editorialized against the repeal, even though they knew their hometown congressman was the one, the Murphy Amendment was the one fighting to repeal it. And that's okay, because as I taught my kids, who were very young then, one's in high school and one's still in grade school. But I, you know, I said to them, hey, this daddy has this job, but it's not to get reelected. My job is to serve the 700,000 Americans and our country. And character is how you are when nobody's looking. And so, you know, when they're off to college in a couple of years, you know, if they Google their daddy and look at his Wikipedia page, whatever, they're going to see that their dad fought for what was right. Their dad stood up for equality. Their dad was the author of the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in U.S. House of Representatives, and I hope that makes them proud.
Speaking of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, so you testified, right, in front of a U.S. Senate committee, had it? And what were some of your main arguments, I guess, that you made before the committee?
We had a hearing in the in the House side, the House Armed Services Committee and the Personnel Subcommittee for the first time ever. And, you know, we had the opponents that were against the repeal, and there were many. You know, we had people like Elaine Donnelly who testified that, you know, if we repeal the NSL tell, there'll be more rapes in the barracks, that there'll be men making out in formation, et cetera. And I was very clear that if there is any misconduct, whether it's someone who's gay or straight or whatever, it doesn't matter. We have the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which was passed by Congress. We have military regulations that don't allow it if they're a heterosexual couple now. The fact is that there's rules and procedures in place. And the fact is this, is that our military, the American military, is the best of the best. There was no one that can match our power because of the men and women that serve. So to have dozens of other allied countries than ours, Canada, Israel, Great Britain, whatever the case is, you know, they allowed their professional military to serve openly. They didn't kick out their troops because they happened to be gay. And so I took very great offense that they were saying that our American soldiers, our American troops, were not as professional as those other organizations, those other countries' troops. And I found that hard to believe. And you know, I went to my colleagues in the House. I literally talked to every single member of Congress when I led this fight, trying to get them on board. And I went to where they were and listened to what their concerns were. And if there were Republicans that care about fiscal discipline, I let them know how this policy cost the American taxpayer over $1.2 billion, beside kicking out 2 to 3 troops every single day. You know, and if it was folks who said, well, I can't because my bishop, my Catholic bishop in my home district will, you know, give me a hard time or won't give me communion, I let them know they take an oath to support the Constitution of the United States of America, that they don't take an oath to the Pope. I happen to be devout Catholic myself. In fact, my mother was a Catholic nun. She was a Immaculate Mary nun. And I told my brother, sister, and I what it was to stand up for those who are less fortunate, to those who are least among us, to those who are quick sometimes to hide behind a religion, but their heart is filled with hate and not with grace. And so these are the fights that, you know, I, my brother, sister, and I, and those like us are willing to take on then and are willing to take on even now today.
So in this whole process of pushing for the repeal, and you partially answered this already, but what were some of the most surprising questions or comments you received as you were talking to people?
I think, you know, you got to remember of my generation of Iraq, Afghanistan veterans, it's less than 1% of the country that serves during this time, the longest wars in American history. So they didn't understand that we were kicking out fighter pilots. They were kicking out doctors. They were kicking out Arabic speakers just because they were gay. Again, not for misconduct. And I think that's what where the rub is. People didn't understand that you were automatically thrown out. It wasn't a commander's discretion. You were automatically thrown out of the military if there was a SAM, a statement, an act, or a marriage. Meaning you said that you were gay. Two, they caught you in the act or they saw pictures. Or three, you showed them a marriage certificate that you got married or a civil union. That would automatically trigger a chapter process to throw you out of the military. And it was wrong. So that's what I think probably, frankly, surprised me the most, because you just kind of assume that they would know that, but I had to walk people through it. And then how people didn't have trust and confidence in our military to act like professionals. I had a member of Congress got in my face and, you know, said that I'm going to have blood on my hands because there's going to be gays and lesbians that are going to be murdered in the barracks because of what I was doing. And I let him know very clearly and very sternly. One, to get out of my face, but two, that this was a generational thing, that, you know, he was frankly too old to understand that our younger Americans don't care about who you love. They just care whether or not we truly have equality in our nation. And if we abide by the U.S. Constitution, that blueprint of our democracy, that is a pretty awesome document.
I think that generational divide is kind of interesting because you had mentioned when we met earlier that the military could serve as a model or an agent of social change, which isn't necessarily, I think, how certainly like my parents never thought of it that way. So it's fascinating to think of it in those terms, which makes a lot of sense, though, as you're describing.
Yeah, listen, I love the military. It changed my life for the better. I think those who serve in uniform are civic assets to this nation. They are leaders of character for a lifetime of service. But our military has been this, it's not a breeding ground. It's not some type of, social experiment. It is a fighting force. But that those generations of men and women that were America's fighting force have changed our country for the better. After World War II, Americans who went to college or university under the GI Bill, we democratized education. We expanded the middle class in America. Tens of thousands of doctors, lawyers, engineers, accountants utilized the GI Bill. When half our country was still segregated during the middle of the Korean War, where we had, colored water fountains and colored restaurants and colored counters. We desegregated the military through an executive order by President Truman. We had actually general officers and civilian leaders resign because that was so progressive at the time. But President Truman was righteous. President Truman said, we all wear green and we bleed red. And we don't care what color of your skin that you have, that you serve this nation in past wars and in this war, and we are not going to segregate you any longer. That was pretty powerful and ushered in the Civil Rights Act, or helped usher in the Civil Rights Act. And then clearly, if you read the Obergefell decision in the U.S. Supreme Court, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell ushered in marriage equality in our great nation. That you can now marry the person that you love your heart with the most. And so that was examples of how our military has been a phenomenal change agent in America to make it, frankly, what our preamble of our Constitution says, a more perfect union.
Obviously, you appear on a number of different TV networks. What do you tell people when they ask you, why you appear on certain channels or give interviews to certain people or publications? What do you tell them?
Yeah, listen, I'm probably one of the only folks in America that had his own show on MSNBC and had his own show on Fox. And I'm still now on Fox. But to me, it's, leadership is the art of inclusion. Leadership is inspiring others to do something they otherwise would not do. So whether I'm on Fox Business or Fox News or Fox Nation, I'm fighting the fight. I don't tailor my message to a certain audience. I tailor my message to my fellow Americans. And I let them know straight up when I agree with the administration or when I don't. And I happen to be a proud Democrat and a proud Catholic and a proud American. But whether it's the Catholic Church, the United States of America, the U.S. Army, none of those organizations are perfect. But you know what makes our country great? The fact that we're a good country and that we have this Constitution, this blueprint of our nation, that is a living, breathing document that says in the preamble, in order to form a more perfect union. And so, that preamble and that Constitution is what every member of Congress, which every member of our armed services takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And so that is a righteous and powerful oath that I still take to this day that I think is something that guides me and guides my actions. And whether those actions or commentary are on Fox News or MSNBC, it's something that I give it to the American people straight. And I think they appreciate that because I don't think they like people who talk out both sides of their mouth.
As you know, we work with teachers, and sometimes teachers are under fire, right, for teaching all kinds of things that are labeled divisive concepts, right? So what would you say, or what advice would you offer to those who argue that teaching accurate, inclusive history is divisive?
Well, listen, our country is an incredible melting pot. And so talking about the melting pot, talking about our differences is a positive thing. But for those teachers, the message I would give them would be, thank you, thank you, thank you. You are doing God's work. My sister's a public school teacher. She's been for decades. My sister-in-law is one. You know, I've been teaching, whether it's at West Point or now at the University of Pennsylvania at the Wharton School of Business. It is a, you know, such an incredible profession. You all don't get paid enough. Honestly, you really don't. But I just want you to know there are so many of us that appreciate you, what you do. You know, I tell parents, you know, if you think being a parent is hard, imagine parenting, you know, 20 kids at the same time, 8 hours a day. And, you know, some of those parents that you're teaching, you know, you're the surrogate parent for those young men and women that you have that opportunity to mold, to teach. Imagine I'm being supported, you know, by the parents. And I know it's disheartening at times, but the overwhelming majority of Americans appreciate our teachers, know that the sacrifice that you make to be there, you know, for their children, to create a better America, a better community, to teach them the love of country, to teach them the love of learning, to teach them how important books are and how it is that America came to where we are today, and our inclusive nature, that no matter what, where our ancestors may have come from, and no matter what our skin color might be, whatever God we may or may not follow, the fact is this, is that we're United States Americans. And, you know, we are red, white, and blue. And we have a duty to make this country better every single day and make it better for our children tomorrow than we got it today. And if you're a teacher or a student that's listening to this, when you see something that's wrong, you have a duty to make it right, to do your little part, to tell that story about there was a wrongs happening in America, and are you going to be part of the solution? Or are you going to look the other way and hope, well, it's not going to happen to me, or it's not going to happen to my brother or sister or my kids? It might. And you know what? You got to believe that our country is a good country. And you got to believe that we're a good country because we understand that we're not perfect, but we got to strive every day to make it a better one. And whether that's equality, when you talk about LGBTQ plus, or whether it's equality about school systems or opportunities professionally, we all have a duty to make it better in this great nation of ours and in our community. We're this incredible melting pot of different nationalities, of different faiths, different sexual orientations, you know, of differences. But if we unite and we come together and we strive to meet people where they are, we strive to make it a little bit easier, to make it a little bit more equitable, to make it a little bit more of an opportunity for all of us tomorrow than it is today, we'll have a better community, and we'll have a better country because of your efforts.
We extend tremendous gratitude to Patrick Murphy for not only taking the time to speak with us, but most importantly, for enlightening policymakers and changing the course of history for an incalculable number of Americans. And as promised in the intro, the behind-the-scenes serendipity of this episode is this. I enlisted in the U.S. Army in 1986 as a 98 Gulf, a Korean linguist, before the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. In 1988, I was discharged from the military, and my DD-214 discharge document reads, fraudulent entry, because I had checked the box no in response to an entrance form question that asked if I was a homosexual. It's a very long story, which you can read in Vincent Gianni's award-winning book, Gays in the Military.
Hi, this is Danny Roberts, and I was on MTV's The Real World New Orleans in 2000 and became one of a few groundbreakers out on national television at the time. My season drew attention to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy due to my on-screen relationship with a covert U.S. Army captain. In 2022, Patrick Murphy reached out to me on social media with the following message. appreciate your work. I was a young Army captain in 2000 teaching at West Point and watching you on MTV. Went on to do 2 combat deployments and came home and ran and won to become the first Iraq vet in the U.S. Congress. The Murphy Amendment was the bill that finally repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and I want to thank you for influencing me to always do the right thing. If I can ever be helpful, please let me know.
Danny's tremendous courage to be out on national television nearly a quarter of a century ago, which has impacted his life ever since, and Patrick's courage a decade later to do the right thing, knowing it would probably impede his reelection, are both shining examples of how honesty and visibility can be revolutionary. Kathleen Barker is History and Erase Program Director and is a Library and Information Specialist and Public Historian with more than 20 years of experience as a museum and library educator. This podcast is funded by the New York City Council. It was developed by History and Erased and produced and edited by Dynamac, our Youth Equity Program Director and podcaster. Our theme music is 1986 by Brother D via Tribe of Noise. Please rate this podcast and share. I'm Deb Fowler. Thanks for listening.